Welcome to Real Vision Live. For Real Vision, I'm Max Wheathy. I'm joined today by Paul Hodges, the founder of New Normal Consulting and editor-at-large of the PH Report. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you, Max.
All right. So you've been on Real Vision many times before. I'm sure some viewers are quite familiar with your perspective on the world, but you do bring a unique outlook on understanding what's happening in the global economy and financial markets. You have some, you know, the title of your firm, you know, the new normal really speaks a lot to, you know, how you are viewing the world. And I think you have a chart that you start out with in your PH report, which I think is the best place for us to start here today. So I want to pull up this chart that is your major trend shifts that you think are happening right now. And if you could just explain to us what each of these key paradigm shifts are, the stages and development they're in, and how investors need to be considering these to really think about what's happening moving forward.
Right. Thank you, Max. Yes. So just that's a bit of background to put them in context. What we did around sort of April or May last year was it was in fact the deputy mayor of Milan who came up with the word, talking about what was happening in the automotive industry in Milan, and he said there are things that we thought would be happening in 2030 which are actually happening now, and that was really the clue that the you go along. And life seems to be pretty much as usual, a bit of change here, a bit of there. And then suddenly you hit a tipping point and the world changes, not quite overnight, but very quickly indeed. And so as we thought about that sort of in the first half of last year since then, what we said was there's five key paradigm shifts happening here. First one is in demand patterns. And you know, I just put up some industries there: travel, leisure, construction, real estate, major change. You know, I've been on a plane once in the last 9 months. There have been times in my life where I traveled with a passport in my jacket pocket because I was traveling so much. I've probably traveled on average on a plane at least once a fortnight, if not once a week. Most of, you know, so that's all changed. You look at restaurants, which have been open and shut. I mean, here in Europe, most of the leisure industry is shut down. I think there were at Gatwick, which is the third largest London airport, there were 60 flights the other day, normally hundreds. So they're really massive change. And who's working in offices these days? You know, what's that doing to the real estate market? So that's one very obvious area. Then there's reshoring. And we've got another one of these examples going on at the moment where you look at the semiconductor industry. You know, we had problems a year ago with getting pharma raw materials out of China and India because of export restrictions and travel restrictions and so on. And now here we are again with a worldwide shortage in semiconductors and car firms saying, we're going to have to cut back. Toyota in the States, various others have all cut back production because they can't get hold on these vital components. And you know, we're talking about just in time in the past, and now what we're talking about is just too late. They're just not coming. So then you've got energy abundance. So you've got, and Texas is quite a good example of this. As you start to increase the amount of renewables, so you also have to increase the amount of backup supply. Because it's pretty obvious that if you get cold weather, you don't get a lot of sunshine and you just power the solar, and you don't get a lot of wind to power wind. So if you want to have renewables because you're keen on climate change, doing something like climate change, you have to have backup. And what that means is that at some periods you have expensive energy, but at some periods you have negative priced energy, because you've got wind and solar are running, all the rest are around, and you can virtually give it away. So that's a really big change. Then the circular economy, we're seeing enormous pressure today on recycling of plastics. Talk to the big brand owners, P&G, Unilever, Danone, all these people. You see, they're all saying the consumer wants recycled plastic. Now, what does that do to established plastics manufacturing from virgin oil? Virgin gas doesn't do a lot for it. So you're moving to a new business model there. And I'm sure that's going to really push forward because we've got COP26, the climate change conference, coming up at the end of the year in Glasgow in Scotland. And you can already see that global world is you've got Biden in the White House, you've got the European Commission and European Union here, and China all pushing to go faster here. So that is going to be a big thing. And then, of course, if you've got reshoring going on, if you're moving to the circular economy, well, you're not going to carry on using the same old rubbish manufacturing technologies that you used to use in the past. You've got digital, you've got continuous, you've got biotech-enabled technologies, which are, as it says, safer, greener, faster, and cheaper. Yeah, there's inertia, and that really is the final point. You've got, in all these things, what happens is you have inertia. And people say, yeah, I understand what you're talking about, but really, on the other hand, and so on. And then something happens. And that something was the pandemic. And at that point, you hit a tipping point and you start to go up the S curve so that you're going along like this. You know, the incumbents say, told you nothing would ever happen. And then, oh, wait a minute. Well, you're joking. And, you know, change, we know that change comes and change is underway. We think these are five key areas. Other people, you know, viewers will have their own ideas as well. And, you know, we're probably all right.
Yeah. Well, one of the industries that you track to monitor these sorts of trends is obviously the chemical industry. Fits very well with the title of the PH report. There's this chart you have of the capacity utilization, which actually prior to the change to new normal, you were using to show the peak in demand, that we were never going to go back to this demand constantly growing paradigm that existed for really much of your career. Now, we've seen some interesting things which have come up probably surprisingly to you, where we've really popped right back up in terms of capacity utilization. So how are you making sense of this chart in light of what you previously thought, that we wouldn't be coming back up to levels like this before?
Well, we've got, I mean, this is, I think, one of the single most fascinating charts that we've had for some time, because yeah, we never mess around with this chart. It's the data that comes from the American Chemistry Council, and that's it. You know, we don't try and say, oh, yes, but this or whatever. But what you saw in December, and the data starts, we have data going back to 1987, so we've got quite a lot of data here. We've got 30-odd years of data. We've never had as big a rise in December as we had in December last year. And so you ask yourself, what happened? Because normally in December, you know, companies are getting ready for Christmas and the holidays. They've got tax reasons. They've got working capital. Investors are monitoring their end year working capital and so on. So you always, and I say always, see at best a flattening or a slight downturn. So we've seen the single largest increase in capacity utilization we have ever seen in December. So we go around and we ask our friends in the industry, what's happening here? And the answer is buyers. And remember, buyers, you know, but buyers lose their bonuses if they pay too much. They lose their jobs if their plants run out of product. So losing your running out of product is pretty serious. And what we're seeing is, because of all the supply hiccups around the world, not just semiconductors. I mean, for example, containers. A container that you could get, you could bring from Shanghai to the West Coast for $1,500 four or five months ago was costing $8,000. Right? And buyers are absolutely nervous about supply. So, you know, you come along to me and say you've got some product. I say, thanks, Max, I'll take it. Anybody who comes along and you're placing multiple orders in order to try and ensure that you get at least one of them delivered. So, you know, and I think this is part of the strange mentality that we've got here, because it's very clear. If you look at what's happening in Europe, for example, which is a very large market, it's all in lockdown. And the UK has just announced this, you know, a tentative roadmap, which says that maybe if we're lucky, we go back to something like normal by the end of the first half of the year, by June, right? So we won't be able to go to pubs or anything like that until June, or whatever. You know, maybe, you know, schools hopefully will reopen in a couple of weeks. You look at around the States, you see, you know, similar kind of patterns going on, and you see in China, that domestic consumption is relatively low. It was down 8% last year. China's been doing an export boom. So China's been exporting. There hasn't been anything going back. So the containers are stuck in Europe and the States. And so what you've got is this concept of apparent demand. And, I'd be delighted to be proved wrong. I'd be delighted to think that we're moving off on a real new boom, but I'm absolutely certain we're not.
Okay. Yeah, we actually got a question about that I think is relevant here. Let me see if I can find it. So Lily wants to know what your thoughts are on the inflation story. She says, I believe you're more in the deflation camp, but perhaps his views have changed, or it might be a timing view where inflation in the short term due to supply chain disruptions, fiscal vaccines, but to deflation longer term. If you could discuss the timing of things and whether do you even see these price rises as being correctly categorized as inflation, or is this purely a one-off scenario?
Yeah, I think that it's a very good question. I'll try and answer it really in two parts. So we are fundamentally, as Lily says, in a position of being favored deflation for the very simple reason that the majority of population increase in the States, in Europe, and in China over the next 10 years is in the 55 plus cohort. People age 55 plus, like myself, we're wonderful people, but we are a replacement economy. We're not going out like you, Max, and having babies and, needing to buy things for the first time. When something goes wrong, if our sofa collapses, then we have to buy another one. But we don't, in principle, we're not buying our first one. So we've got a lot of supply available to us because of globalization, but we're not going to see all that. So longer term, if you look at the trend over the last 20 or 30 years, there's a trend lines going very clearly down. But within those trend lines, of course, you get bumps. We had a pretty bad downturn, about this time last year for 3 months. When you've got WTI crude oil going to a negative price, that's quite significant in terms of all the things that crude. So even if you don't have an increase in pricing, if you just had a kind of sort of $30 or $40 crude oil, that would be an enormous inflation, temporary inflation, compared to where you were in March and April last year of minus 40 at the bottom. So I think that you see these swings and roundabouts, which we've seen for 20 or 30 years. And one of the reasons why we really like the chemical industry is that you can look at a chart like this of major regions, and you can see the major sectors. And you can see that actually all of the major sectors are now doing pretty well. You're up 5 or 6% as a minimum, and you're up to 8 or 9 in plastics. And we know why, obviously, because people are they're buying online, and they're worried about health risks and so on, so they want individual packaging. And so some logic going on there. They're working from home a lot, so they're trying to make their homes better, more comfortable. So obviously, one of the things you do is paint it and use coatings and so on, things like that. So you can see very real reasons why this should be happening. What's interesting, of course, is, as I was saying, if you look at China, what you see is China is up 12% over last year. Now, obviously, it's a recovery because China was locked down a year ago, but it's also because it's had an export-led recovery. And it's banged out all of this stuff around the world because its factories came back 3 months before anybody else's did. So it's pushed all this stuff out. So it's taken, I've seen some estimates, it's early stage estimates, it's taken 1.5% of global GDP through its export focus. Now, that's obviously unsustainable as other regions come back. So my guess is that sometime around the mid-year, we'll start to see inflation coming back down again. But I fully expect, given what happened in March and April last year, that inflation as I say, even if demand was just at a sort of a normal level and wasn't being boosted by supply shortages, I would expect to see some inflation at the moment.
Okay. So I actually want to skip ahead a little bit because you opened up the door to talking about oil. You make an interesting case for what has driven the price of oil recently, really not being this demand story that many people are focusing on, but that it's actually sort of the financialization of the sector. So I want to bring up this chart here of the world oil output versus futures. So we got a question from Jin, which I think is very relevant here. He says, are you surprised at oil prices since last March and how much it has recovered? Where do you see oil prices at the end of the year? And I'm just going to expand that to more of a general perspective on oil markets.
Yeah, well, let's start by saying I have no great antipathy to futures markets. In fact, when I was working in Houston, in Texas, in the mid-80s, I'm working for a company called ICI, which is a big oil player, and I was actually one of those who was helping to set up the futures market and get contracts organized and getting companies like my own to participate. Because if you're in the oil and chemical business, you're completely locked into whatever is happening in the oil and gas markets. And if you're all talking to each other, you've all got the same view. And you need somebody, you know, we used to talk about the New York and Belgian dentists coming in, you know, wealthy individuals who fancied a punt and they could make money at our expense. But on the other hand, that what they did was they took liquidity instead of just being us, they doubled the amount of liquidity. So we could always hedge when we wanted to. And that was fine. You know, that contract, worked as it was supposed to do for 20 years. We're showing we have the data from 96, but it was more or less the same going back to 85, 86 when the contract started. And then in 05, you got the first move up of the hedge funds coming in. Then they got a bit beaten down. And then they discovered this new thing of paired trading. And like all things, it's got some semblance of logic to it. It is undeniably true that if the dollar is weak, then people outside the States can afford to buy more oil and the other way around. Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if the dollar is weak, that people will buy more oil. However, if you're a hedge fund and if you're playing on quants, then what you do is you say, we'll program the machine to operate on that basis. And what you then have is the physical market of supply and demand, which was already by 2010 or so in danger of being swamped. You know, we saw it. You know, crude went from $146 in June 2008, and it was down at 30 by the end of the year. You know, the hedge funds had taken it completely to a ridiculous level, right? And then they did it again. And of course, every time you build up these circumstances, so you add another layer to the onion. And the other layer that happened with OPEC coming out of the last downturn in 2014, 2015, was that they opened up a dialogue with the hedge funds. And not illegal. I mean, we're in our report for clients. You know, we actually quote the Wall Street Journal, which broke the story publicly, as it were. We knew it was happening, obviously, but there it was in print, so we can now actually talk about it. And you know, there were oil market analysts introducing 100 of the largest hedge funds to OPEC, and OPEC saying, "Well, this is what we're going to do," and the hedge funds saying, "Well, this looks like easy money, doesn't it? Let's go and buy then." And you know, and so. In what's very interesting, in the whole period since 2009, we have never once had a genuine supply shortage. You know, we've seen the price go up from minus 40. Okay, that's a bit spectacular, but we've gone up from 25 to 65 over the past year. Not a single supply shortage anywhere in the world. Now, I used to be an oil trader. I used to work for a chemicals company. You only ever used to see spikes in the oil price, a doubling or more, if you had genuine shortages. That's not happening today. We're simply at the mercy of financial speculation. And what is worse about it, and the bit that does get me, I mean, Michael Lewis wrote about this in Flash Boys, obviously, but the bit that gets me is, and we saw it today, Goldman published a story that says the oil price is going to go up 10, faster and so on. It doesn't matter whether Goldman are right or wrong. All the quants see the headline, buy. And there it is. It's suddenly, it was down 20, 30 cents at the beginning of the day. And it, last time I looked, it was up $1.50. Nothing had changed. Goldman made a forecast. Oh, really? Yeah, I've seen that before. Goldman were bullish. Well, show me a time when Goldman aren't bullish. That's how they make their money, So why is the market reacting to this? The market is not, reacting to real events. The market is reacting to what financial players are doing. Where do I think this ends? I'm old enough to think still that in the end, supply and demand will matter. So I'm going to, I'm quite happy to put $25 or $30 down as the price for the end of the year. Because what we've now got, and OPEC, I think, is starting to wake up to this. And I think there's, what we're going to see in the second quarter is some big rows in OPEC Plus. Because what have you got? On the one hand, you've got prices high enough to allow US shale back in the game. And we've already more than doubled the number of drilling rigs since August, and more is coming out. And of course, all the producers say, of course, this time round, we're going to be very responsible. Hello? When have you ever seen a shale oil producer being responsible? They make as much money as they can when they can. Perfectly reasonable strategy. So, so shale is going to produce as much as it can, as quickly as it can, and it will hedge. I think people have learned their lesson from the last collapse, and they will hedge. So even when the market goes down, they'll carry on producing. Secondly, we've got COP26, the climate change conference, coming up. So we've got enormous pressure now for more renewables to be used. And the higher the oil price, the more you hasten the transition, the paradigm shift from fossil fuels to renewables. Because you look at the pricing and you say, well, actually, for example, here in Portugal, last summer, Portugal bought solar power at €13.18 a megawatt hour. Why would you be paying today's prices for oil when you know that you've got a built-in margin there? So that's what will happen. And then, of course, the third one is that Saudi were relying on Trump, and Trump keeping aligned with the Texas oil industry, because he wanted to get the Texas and Louisiana and so on votes in the election. Nothing particularly clever or needing a lot of detective work to work that one out. But of course, Trump isn't there anymore. Biden, yeah, he has a bit of some oil votes up in Pennsylvania, but by and large, he's fairly neutral on it, and he's much more concerned about jobs. And jobs in the new economy, the new normal economy, that's his core focus. And of course, and also he wants to get the Iran deal back, because the dangers of not having an Iran deal for the world peace are incredible. So I think we're going to start to see much more Iranian oil coming onto the market. We're going to see many more disputes within OPEC Plus, because Russia's hardly cut back. Russia doesn't believe in cutting back. We've seen this for 30 years. They announce all sorts of things. When you get to the numbers, it was the wrong kind of snow in Siberia, and we really had to, and it's very unfortunate, and we wish we hadn't, but there you go. That's the way of it, sort of thing. So you've got the Russians doing their own thing there. You've got the Iranians who haven't got a quota, but obviously very important players. You've got Iraq needing the cash quite desperately. And you've got other players around, Nigeria. Venezuela may well come back. Venezuela could be a very big provider. It's not been cut out. If we start to see Venezuelan oil coming back, you could see a million barrels. So there's a lot of oil around. There aren't any shortages. There haven't been any shortages. And at some moment, my personal view, or our personal house view, is that the supply demand will suddenly become blindingly obvious to everyone. And so why on earth are prices this high? By which time, I'm sure that our friends in hedge funds will have sold short.
So the question, though, is how high can it go? Between the time that – I'm sorry, just getting a little echo there. Let me back up from my mic a little bit. So between now and your $25, $30 price target, you know, Nick says he's long right now, and he sees, you know, why not $100 a barrel this summer? Do you think that's possible, that we could – that this could continue much further than you would have expected before we actually see this realization of the supply and demand dynamics?
Well, I'm glad you've chosen that particular chart, Max, because what we've been saying for a while to our clients, as you know, is that when you get technical trading like this, which has nothing to do with supply and demand, you might as well look on the Fibonacci retracement levels. And so there's our view of the Fibonacci retracement level going back since the last fall. So yeah, we think it could go up to somewhere near 70. We hit the 61 10 days ago. You hit the 50. I would be surprised if we go much higher. I mean, we can do it for a day or two, but if you do it stably, because by, you know, quite a long time, if you look at those green candlestick charts there, you know, we've been going up very, very steadily at, you know, not quite a vertical level, but pretty close to a vertical level. So that is usually a sign that you come to an unhappy end. So, you know, if somebody wanted to say, oh, we'll get to, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with Goldman that it could get to 75, but Goldman is saying it because, you know, they want it to happen. And I'm saying, well, you know, it will only go up there because it's going to come down afterwards, which I don't think is a view that Goldman share.
Yeah. So I guess he also comments about a supply squeeze. I'm sure that's related to the shutdowns that happened down in Texas because of the inclement weather. How do you think about that? You know, we do have some supply coming offline, at least in Texas, because of the inclement weather. Is that going to affect your outlook?
Well, I mean, the weather is a double-edged sword from a fossil fuel position. Because when I was living in Houston in the 80s, of course, you used to get hurricanes, you used to get the odd light dusting of snow and so on, and all that would come through and so on. But it never lasted particularly. You know, now we've had the big hurricanes 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and now we have the snow. And that really does start, you know, even the most climate skeptic starts to say, you know, there might be something in this because we haven't seen this before. So that tends to destabilize fossil fuel demand, and you look at, I mean, you know, nobody knows the answer, but BP, who are a pretty large oil company, said, we think we saw peak oil demand last year. We know in the States that 68% of oil demand is in transportation. And you can see GM saying, we're not going to be selling fossil fuel-based cars past 2035. So, you know, you can argue that what the, in the medium to longer term, what this is doing is encouraging and speeding up the demise of gasoline and diesel demand, and therefore, in the largest user of oil, I think you're going to see a decline. In the short term, one has to remember that we see this every year. We always have shutdowns due to hurricanes sometime between August and the end of September, sometimes several. And the oil companies are very experienced at shutting things down and getting them back up again. Now, you could say, okay, this isn't wind, this is cold and so on, and some of those plants will take longer to restart, but the temperature's already come back. You know, you don't get, even today, you don't get snow continuing in Texas for very long, you know, a few days at most. So the temperature's coming back. There's a lot of money at stake to get this right. You don't have to get people out onto drilling rigs or anything else. So I think that we'll be coming back pretty quickly. But of course, there is the other side to this. I don't know the answer to this yet. What has happened to demand? You know, I talked to a lot of our clients who are not necessarily in the oil industry, up in the Northeast, for example, and you can see that there's much, demand is much lower. People are locked down, and at the same time, their actual levels of demand is reducing quite a lot. So I wouldn't be surprised that, yes, the big impact short term was all these plants going offline. But in a way, once you've lost it, you've lost it. You start again and you've got it there. Demand, however, I suspect will take a bit longer to come back. So, these are interesting times, if you like. But I wouldn't be putting a lot of money on the oil markets at this stage to go to 100 unless something really much bigger took place.
Okay. Well, I think this brings us nicely to one of the other major trend shifts that you're talking about, which is the greening of the economy, and fits back in with your Build Back Better argument. So we have a chart here that let's just start out more broadly before we get into autos specifically. But we have a chart here of just the ESG growth in financial markets. I think specifically this looks at new and repurposed funds and then European fund flows over the past few years. So this is, you talk about the big conference that we have coming up. Financial markets are referencing it. The companies themselves, businesses are starting to take note. It is clearly a mega trend. How are you viewing it?
Well, I think we've been highlighting this for a while, and people like Microsoft began to say a year ago, by 2050 we're going to have taken out of our system all the carbon that we've contributed to the economy, sort of stage one, stage two, and stage three, which includes travel rather than just the direct impact. And then you've got people like BlackRock, writing to their CEOs saying, and this is a very interesting point with the letters that they're writing now, to say we're actually going to set up ETFs, so passive ETFs with an ESG bias against on fossil fuels. So you may buy, instead of just buying an S&P ETF to reflect the S&P, you may well have a mandate from a pension fund to say we want you to invest in an ETF that doesn't support fossil fuels. And that's what's now coming. So what I think you're going to see is a lot of pain for fossil fuel manufacturers, for fossil fuel producers. One of the things that I think is very interesting at the moment is the difference between Europe and the States. And I think this is down to Trump, that in Europe, it's been pretty clear to the oil companies, whether it's Shell, whether it's BP, whether it's Total, whether it's one, that the future is not going to be around fossil fuels. You may disagree about whether you've got 10 years or 20 years or whatever it is, but in terms of an oil industry outlook, 10 or 20 years is just round the corner. So they're alive to it. In the States, I think that people allowed themselves to believe for a while, maybe this could carry on longer. Maybe it will be all right. And so I think that the shock in the States is going to be greater. And I'm a great admirer of the States. And one of the things that I've always noticed about the States is that nothing is happening, and nothing is happening. Let's go and talk to a few people and something, but nothing's happening. But wait a minute, I didn't see that coming. And I think that's where we're going to be in 6 months' time on oil and gas. I think that the major US oil companies, seeing the way the wind blows with Biden, with climate change, with COP26, why are you going to start banging your head against a brick wall in this? Why wouldn't you want to get into a growth market for the future? And there are lots of growth markets around this. Doesn't just have to be renewables. So I think you've got investors saying to company managements, if you carry on doing that, we're not going to put much money into you. So your share bonuses and so on, they're going to go down. Is that what you want? Fine. Okay. Right. At the same time, their customers are saying, we don't want your product anymore. So I think that we've already seen that happen in Europe. You won't find any CEO really in Europe, a major European oil company who believes they've got a future in fossil fuels beyond 20 or 25 years. And I think we're going to get to that position in the States as well fairly quickly this year.
Yeah, well, the oil companies are quickly becoming energy companies. You can hear that in their rhetoric. But, you know, pulling up this chart again, it's interesting. You see the number of funds is growing rather steadily, but it's the flows that is really gone parabolic, which I think is extremely interesting. And that's in billions of euros. And I mean, it just really takes off in 2019 and last year, just an absolute record year. And that's the incentive that you're talking about, that there is not only is it a potential growth industry, but the capital is there and the capital is being driven that way. It just strikes me as rather unlikely that American oil companies wouldn't jump on that trend as well.
I mean, the other bit, you know, just to say about that is what you see is that the passive obviously led, but the active is now getting pretty big as well.
Yes. Yeah. The active is huge there. That was actually a big surprise to me. But naturally, another industry that dovetails very nicely into this discussion is auto. So as much as we're going to be discussing both the demand side from COVID and how that has shaped demand, let's start, though, with EVs and how this the same trend that we're talking about in the oil and gas or energy sector is also taking place in autos.
Well, I think the issue with electric vehicles, you know, when somebody comes to write the history of it, will be fascinating, because it really began with two developments. One was in China around pollution and air pollution, and you and I remember, Max, that the American embassy was in Beijing was the only public body that was publishing air pollution numbers in Beijing, and they were holding that. That number up, and it was well beyond anything that WHO was recommending in terms of health and so on. Actually, do we want to go to that's the smaller markets?
I'm just filtering. The charts aren't actually up on screen yet. I was just looking to see whether we had any specifically for EVs. We'll get to the demand stuff.
Right, okay, fine,
I just want to talk more broadly.
Okay, right. So the position on. So you had China moving forward because of air pollution. You know, what's the point of having a wealthier population if you can't breathe the air, drink the water, or eat the food? You know, that is and was the big challenge. So you've got to clean up the economy. You can't just be belching out fumes all the time. And then you get to Europe, and in Europe, what you see is that the Dieselgate saga was the tipping point. Because you had VW and others who were cheating on diesel emissions, and they were cheating on this for years. And you know, you could argue about whether the regulators knew or not, doesn't really matter, but they got found out. And there was this crisis two-day board meeting in Wolfsburg, VW's headquarters, 3-4 years ago, where they basically faced the end of their business. And you know, after recognizing the shock, they then said, well, what else can we do? And the answer was, there's only one thing we can do, which is electric vehicles. And the ironic thing was that the European Commission had already brought in CO2 levels for cars. And they were due to come in last year. And the industry wasn't bothered about this because, yes, you get high CO2 levels from gasoline, but from diesel, they're relatively low. And given the 50-odd%, 55% of the market was diesel, that meant we're laughing. Oh, you mean we're not going to be able to sell diesel anymore? I mean, the diesel over 4 years, diesel market share has gone from 55% of the market to 25%. Oh, as they say in Houston, Higgins, you know, what happens next? And so they had to bring in electric vehicles. They had to do it very fast. And you know, if you're a large manufacturer and you throw money at it, then because you were saving yourself potentially, you know, hundreds of millions of euros here. So you didn't really mind if you were giving away the cars, because you might as well give away a car and build some market share than just hand it over to the government. You know, anybody can see that logic. And so they went like mad at this. And so suddenly you now got a major market going, and Europe became last year because of the new CO2 levels, became the largest market in the world for electric vehicles. China, of course, is also coming up there too. And what you now see is that VW are spending, you know, they've increased the number of cars they're going to produce, the models they're going to do it, and they're going to be spending, you know, tens of billions of euros now on putting out 25 or so different models within the next 3 to 4 years. And what you see is poor old Tesla, is back down with the also-rans now, because the big boys, VW, Renault and so on, are up there now getting the market share that you would expect. VW and Renault between them, almost half of the market in electric vehicles. So, and that will grow very fast. And what you've also got, of course, is countries mandating the end of diesel and gasoline cars. So the UK was mandating the end of that in 2035. They're now mandating the end of it in 2030. Well, you know, Tokyo's done the same, a number of other countries. I'm pretty sure that we'll see other countries doing that in the run-up to COP26. We saw GM announcing last week, I think it was, that they won't be selling diesel or gasoline cars past 2035. I'm pretty sure Mary Barra will bring that date forward in due course as well. And people say, well, yeah, okay, that's 2030, but that gives us a few years. Well, actually, no. Because when you go to buy a car, and whether you're a private buyer or a fleet buyer, one of the things you look at is what's the resale value going to be. So if I buy a new gasoline or diesel car today, and I go to resell it in 26 or 27, usual kind of 5 years or something, what's it going to be worth? Well, if you look at what's happened to the resale market for diesel, not a lot is the answer. So, I think that the buyer will vote with their pocketbook on this. And the important thing is that battery costs have now come down to around the $100 a kilowatt hour. So at the executive car level, the $35,000 level, they're now competitive with gasoline and diesel. And you've got to remember that with electric vehicles, you don't have very much maintenance because there aren't that many moving parts. You know, you have 2,000 moving parts in internal combustion engine car. You have about 200 in an electric vehicle. So it's much simpler, it's much easier. You don't have so much maintenance and so on. You have to do the brakes and things like that, but you don't have to do oil changes or anything because you don't have any oil. Simple things like that. So, it becomes much cheaper. And within a couple of years, and, you know, I'm using Bloomberg numbers, but you know, most people are around the same, the battery costs will be cheaper for most cars. And what's particularly interesting, I thought about what both GM and Ford were saying in their recent quarterly updates, was that they expected the van market to go very quickly. Because if you're in the delivery market, you know what mileage your vans do. You know what it's like, and they're back in the depot at night, so you can recharge them. So you look at the cost. You know, if you're a trucker, if you're a delivery fleet owner, you look at the cost of this, and you say, well, I'm going to say, I think Ford said it's going to be 40% cheaper. Well, 40% gets you to shift. You know, and it's dope, you know, the cars and the vans and so on work. So I think that you're going to see buyers now starting to take a lead on this and moving it forward quite fast. So this has got, and you know, so what we're seeing is two impacts here. One is that the China stimulus effect has disappeared. China's sales, as it says there, were going up. Really, they quadrupled, went up by four times between 2007 and 2018, they've now come down quite a lot. The actual level of cars, if you take the other six big markets, the actual level of car sales last year were exactly the same as they were in 2010. So in other words, there wasn't any growth in the market outside China over the last 10 years. And what we can see is that growth is going to reverse and become negative now. And that, of course, has a number of very interesting implications, because one of the things it does, you know, auto sales, auto production, are usually the biggest employer.
In
manufacturing employer. And, you know, in Europe, for example, it's around 7% of total employment. And that doesn't include all the service stations and so on that you use. It doesn't include the garages where you go to get the checkups and oil changes and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of employment is going to start to disappear in this industry over the next three to five to 10 years. And so this is why, if I was Joe Biden, this is why I would be very, very strongly starting to think about how I can create high-paying jobs out of climate change, because it's too late to hold on to the fossil fuel market. You know, we tried that with Trump. It didn't work. And the world has moved on now. So you either stick your head in the sand and say, oh, well, don't worry, you know, we'll somehow get it back. Or you take the bold step that says, let's create the jobs of the future. And that, I think, is the challenge, you know, uniquely, really, with China, with Europe, and with the States. All three major markets are moving in the same direction.
Okay. Linda has a question. She wants to know who's going to be the winner. Is it going to be the Chinese, US, or Europe? Is there even going to be a winner in terms of...
I think that we'll have... I'm pretty sure that the people who won't be the winner are Tesla. Tesla are now already being left behind. And as people have said, we've said before, the established legacy car manufacturers actually know how to manufacture cars. They know how to manufacture them at scale, and they've got the local contacts to make that work. So I think that the winners will be two sets of people, really. One is in the Western markets. It will be the major companies, VW, Ford, General Motors, Renault, who've all got very, very good EV lineups coming through, performance fine, cost fine, know how to market them and everything else. I think that what we'll see is that in China, those companies that are active in China will obviously be, it's a trial area, you're launching cars there. China is also now, however, making a big push into the Belt and Road markets. In other words, the markets where China has local sway, if you like. Broadly speaking, you've got an aging population in China, and it's surrounded by a lot of young countries. And the stands, for example, going over towards in Asia, towards Iran, going over the up the Gulf into the Middle East and to Africa. So you've got young populations there. And what I think China will do is to build up its sales of lower price, much lower priced cars. You know, you're talking about cars that cost $5,000 or $10,000 on average, rather than the average, whatever it is, $38,000 in the States. So I think that it isn't quite a cheap and cheerful market, but you'll see that kind of division. So China will do pretty well in the lower cost market, and the Western producers will do pretty well in the more established developed world markets.
So there is one exception, though, that you highlighted in your report to the shift towards EVs, which is less developed markets are not quite ready to make the full shift. And you said, I think you highlighted Russia and India as examples of countries that are just not ready to make the full EV shift for whatever reason, and are still focusing on gasoline or diesel powered vehicles and really focusing on making cheaper cars. So there are some exceptions. It's not truly a global trend yet.
Well, it's what I'd say is that you still have for example, for a long time after leaded gasoline was phased out in the States, you had exceptions, particularly in the agricultural area. And I remember my friends at Sun Oil used to make a killing out of it. I can't probably shouldn't say killing, but they used to make healthy profits out of this because they had a captive market. They were the last player in the game. And I think that what you're seeing, if you're a company, you tend to sort of tick on in the market. You're there. Inertia's been there. Ford, for example, has had the highest selling cars, for some time in the past in markets like Brazil and Russia. And so, you know, you tick over, you've got the supply chain and so on. And then you get to the point, well, are we going to invest to produce the new models? And that's the key, because then the bean counters come along and they say, well, hang on a moment. You know, you're actually selling 20 or 30% less than you were 5 years ago. Can you show me why you'll be selling even that number in the future? Well, I think it will probably, you know, come on, show me why. And they say, well, you can't justify it. So we're not going to give you the cash. We're going to put all our money where we know we can get a return in Europe and the States and China. So markets like Brazil and India and Russia, what happens is you get left with what nobody else wants to do. So exactly as you say, in Russia, Peugeot, I think it is, you know, I'll say, okay, well, you know, we're going to need diesel engines for a while, so let's manufacture them cheaply in Russia.
Yeah.
And so you get that residual market. But that's not really what you want to be, but it's better than nothing.
Yep. Okay, so I want to get to some questions from the audience here before we let you go in a few minutes. Rolf has a question. Are the share price increases of manufacturers for renewable energies, wind, solar, geothermal, etc., in the last year sustainable, or do you think that this recent rise in price is a bit of an overshoot?
All these things, you wander along and you talk about these things for a while and don't take any notice at all, and you think, well, maybe I'm wrong, you know, and then it suddenly goes the other direction. I mean, the CEO of Total said last week, you know, the prices for renewable businesses to buy are highly inflated. But, I mean, the way I look at this is I'm a value investor myself, and I go back to Ben Graham, and you know, the father of value investing. And you know, Ben had this rule that if you look at a company's likely earnings over the next 10 years, then you think it's going to be flat, then in his mind, that deserves a price earnings ratio of 8.5. And every 1% of growth that you thought the company could sustain over that 10 years, you would add 2 points to it. So if you're looking at a PE of 18.5, for example, that means that you're expecting the company to grow at 5% a year for the next decade. And so I think it's a very good question. And the way I look at it is, let's think, rather than the addressable market, which I always get a bit nervous about, you know, you could sell an awful lot of apples in China if every one of 1.4 billion people decided to buy an apple. It's an addressable market, but it's probably not real. You know, how many EVs are you likely to sell? And with renewables, how quickly is that transition going to take place? And what's the price level at which you're going to be selling? Because you've seen some very low levels of price. So I think that from an investment point of view, if you're not in the business and you've got a choice, I would be looking at some of the areas which have tended to sort of fall behind a bit. You know, hydrogen, I think, is a very interesting area. We don't quite know how it's going to work out yet, so it may not work out. Using ammonia as a carrier for hydrogen could be, I think, quite a big market. But there's not a lot of evidence at the moment to back me up.
So,
you know, if you're prepared to do the work, you might get yourself comfortable, and there would be an attractive kind of operation.
Well, Paul, you talked about the more established oil and gas companies realizing that they need to shift their businesses, obviously, and they're getting capital to acquire new companies. Is there any opportunity in the sort of private to public arbitrage where maybe these private companies, which could get acquired by the more traditional folks, are trading at lower multiples because they haven't been driven up by speculators in the market, and thus you're able to buy these more established players, which are being viewed as the old economy, but they're in the process of shifting, and they're going to actually be stepping in, buying these private companies at better valuations and shifting their business. So, you know, you're buying value now because it's being underappreciated, and the growth is although it's not there yet, it's coming in the future as they shift their businesses. Is that something that you may consider?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point, Max. I mean, you can make an argument. I mean, let's just take Shell as a case study. Shell have put quite a lot of money in gas, which is probably not a good idea for the medium to long term. Probably regretting that they wouldn't say it publicly. But they are moving very much into battery charging and charging systems made new investments. I think that we haven't yet got into the real market of how are we going to operate electric vehicles. In China, for example, there's a very interesting business model that NIO, one of the big players, has set up with CATL, which is a really big battery company, where they say, look, we'll take $10,000 off the price of your EV car, and we'll charge you each month roughly the amount of money that you'd spend on gasoline, and we'll charge you that for recharging. And don't you worry about the battery or what happens when it gets upgraded and changes and so on. We'll manage all that for you. And I think that battery exchange could become, in certain markets, a very interesting area, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, to everybody, to start setting up their own private high-speed charging. And you've got millions around the world of service stations with prime real estate in the middle of cities and everything else where you want it. So if you could set up a system where you just go in and look, I want a Ford battery, I want a GM battery, whatever it is, and they just say, right, sit there, sir, have a cup of coffee, sit there, madam, I think that could work quite well. So I think that those are the kind of areas where rather than sort of jumping in and saying, oh, we think everything is going to go well, one's got to be able to form a judgment about which are the models that are going to come through. I think for battery exchange, governments have got to get involved. One of the things that happened with mobile phones, with cell phones, is this happened. Government said, it's completely mad that every manufacturer of cell phones has a different standard. You're all going to use the same standard. We don't want a billion charging leads thrown away every year. And so I think the governments might get involved in this, and that would be quite a game changer.
Okay. David has a question. What do governments do to replace the revenue source with the shift to electric?
Very good question. I mean, there's all sorts of taxes. That's again, I don't want to sound a bit like a broken record, but that's again, if I was in government and if I was in Treasury, I would be saying, if I just let everybody charge at home, I'm going to lose an awful lot of revenue, because most countries, I mean, I know various states and the states don't do this, but most countries make quite a bit of income out of gasoline taxes, out of registration taxes each year, and so on and so forth. Registration taxes will still be there, but the gasoline taxes won't. So if you could actually get people into a monthly payment system, you can tax it. And, that treasuries are there to tax. And, the famous phrase, you want to find the tax that enables you to extract the feather from the golden goose with the minimum amount of angst. I could see quite a lot of it. It's a bit a different market altogether. But, one of the main reasons why did we get to taxes on cigarettes? Okay, there are a lot of health campaigners and everything else. One of the reasons was Treasury people said, this would be quite good. If we put on a tax, everybody would thank us for it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even smokers are glad that you tax them, because it makes them smoke a bit less.
I don't know if I'll concede that point. I've met a few smokers who don't care, but Perhaps there are a few out there who have found that they've reduced just because of cost.
Me, Max, I'm just stirring the pot a bit.
Yeah. Well, I do have two more questions I want to get to before we let you go. So Sarah has a question about silver and lithium supplies for new energy. What do you think about those markets? And I'll expand that a little bit. If you have any other commodities that you think are of particular importance where there is a supply or demand imbalance.
Yeah, well, I think we're at the cusp of some major changes here. I talked a bit earlier about S-curves, and what happens with S-curves is you tend to spend a lot of time trying to work out what the business model is. Nothing much happens. And then suddenly you get it right one morning And yeah, you know, and we've seen this with smartphones. We've seen this, you know, all the way through history. You know, everybody has a smartphone within a week, sort of thing. I think the interesting question around lithium and silver is clearly that there's a lot of demand coming down, and you have to ask yourself, what are we going to do with the lithium and silver that we've already used? You know, at the moment we have this thing called waste sites, where you know we bung it all in the trash can and we throw it away, and you know the metal leaches out and pollutes the land. So it's not very clever, and so on. But it's also not very clever because, as with recycling generally, plastics recycling, everything else, you're throwing away a very valuable molecule. And I saw that one of the ex-Tesla people has been raising money for lithium recovery. And it starts to, you know, if you're a city and you're rather short of cash, which I think most cities are, one of the things you could start to do is to set up proper recycling centres and start to earn some real money for this, because, you know, big cities, so Houston, New York, San Francisco, and so on, you're throwing away hundreds of millions of dollars worth of raw materials. And it would be worth it getting companies to come and invest to pick that up. So I think that she's absolutely right that in the short term, you're going to see pressure on prices there. I'm not a member of Robinhood. I can talk about that. I think that you know, as prices start to move up, as I expect, then what will also do is encourage, as markets normally work, encourage the market to start thinking about more recycling. And recycling you could do relatively quickly. And you know, there's a lot of money in it for cities, a lot of money in for the companies to do it. So I suspect in 3 to 5 years that market could be quite well developed. And it, you know, it's an area to keep an eye on, because once it starts to happen, if you identify the companies that might do well, you'll be getting in on the ground floor in quite a big market.
Yeah. And it could potentially upset some of the high price targets people have for those for those metals, assuming that they have to 100% of the demand has to come from mining.
Yeah.
So final question is a bit of a change of direction here. It's from Steven, who says, I believe Paul mentioned before that he thought US treasuries would have one more leg up and then it would be time to exit. Do you still believe that to be the case, or is this the time to exit that you warned of?
Where I like to see the market, you know, we've had this sort of 30-40 year downturn, and we've come back to what, 1.35% for the 10-year now, which is exactly in the middle of the tram lines where we've been. So I'm not particularly bothered about that at the moment. I think that we've in this game, I tend to look at, are we seeing lower lows and lower highs, or are we seeing higher lows and higher highs? It's a very simple, a bare little brain like myself can get my head around. And so what I haven't yet seen, and you know, I'm quite happy to admit that I could be completely wrong, but I'll give my reasoning. I haven't yet seen people understand the impact of the demographic change that we're going through in the States. You know, whenever people talk about aging populations and everything else, they talk about it from a healthcare point of view. And, you know, I went to a sort of central bank session with all the sort of leading economists there. And I started to talk about it. One of the very prominent economists, everybody will know, said, oh, no, we're not talking about demographics again. And I sort of turned to her and I said, no, actually, what I'd like to do is to talk about demographics for the first time. Demographics has this fantastically negative impact on demand. It's why we are moving from globalization to sustainability. 1950, you had 2.5 billion people in the world. Today, you have 7.8 billion. Most of them are smart young people like yourself. That's all they were, the baby boomers. And you know, they caused a lot of inflation in the 60s and 70s because they were growing up but not actually producing very much. And then from the 80s and 90s and noughts, they were in the labour market. They were producing lots of stuff. They were settling down. They were having families. They were buying lots of stuff. It was a golden era of constant growth. And now the crucial thing is that instead of, you know, getting the gold watch at 65 having a couple of years on the golf course and paying out, they're now there for another 15 years. I mean, you know, I know life expectancy came down last year for a year, but I mean, that's, you know, I don't think that's a long-term trend. That's specific circumstances which we know about. So, you know, the trend is still upwards for life expectancy. And so what you've now got is a set of people, and this is where the majority of population growth in the state is taking place. How can you have inflation? So I think that once that story finally becomes current and consensus, and people don't turn around to me and say, oh, God, we already know that, and they actually do know it, then I think that's the end. But I think these are positions that you trade in and out of, and you know, you're getting close to the point, frankly, where I would start to trade back in again.
Okay, so deflationary impulse still to come, meaning bonds trade higher, yields lower, as people realize the growth that they're pricing into equities is perhaps not within reach.
Well, I think the equity bond dichotomy is very interesting, because if I'm wrong, and if inflation really is taking off, then that's going to have a massive effect on bond yields, and that's going to collapse the stock market. Yep. It always has, always will. So, you know, I wouldn't be praying for inflation if I was an equity market bull.
Yeah. All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much. We've touched on a lot of great topics, and thank you as well to the audience for tuning in and for the great questions. Hopefully we'll have you back again soon.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks very much, Max, and thanks for all the questions. Really good discussion, as always.